Hello, I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark.
And this is Politics Weekly.
Moats, manure and mascara, you name it, they claimed it. This week we chew over the expenses saga which made our politicians look so cheap.
And have you ever heckled in a church? Well, that is how one Labour MP described the sacrilegious act of speaking out against the Speaker, Michael Martin. Well, just to be clear, this pod ain't no church and we will be asking, should Gorbals Mick resign?
And like Rich and Judy, we'll have a little book club as we consider a think tank's demand for a new liberal age.
Today, we welcome Observer's Nick Cohen, and we also have Guardian columnist Madeleine Bunting and Jackie Ashley. Maltesers, mole traps. Madeleine, what was your favourite naughty expense claim?
Airtex swirls on the ceiling and wisteria.
Wisteria, I know. Jackie?
I think it was the pipe under the swimming pool wasn't bad.
Nick?
I'm torn between Barbara Follett's Chinese needlepoint rug, and I like the detail. It's needlepoint, and of course the moat.
Well, there are some goodies, but this week there have been new horrors every single day. Whether it's sweets on the one hand or 5p plastic bags on the other, the real scandal involves dodgy claims for second homes. From Communities Secretary Hazel Bleers to top Tory Michael Gove, the politicians stand charged of flipping their first and second homes around to maximise the payout. And in Elliot Morley's case, for claiming a mortgage that had already been paid off. The whole country seems to be outraged, including The Guardian's top commentators.
I'm Seamus Mill.
Jonathan Friedland.
Michael White, Guardian columnist.
Polly Toynbee, Guardian columnist. It's hard to over-exaggerate how deep a trouble Parliament is over the expenses, because there is no obvious way out.
Trouble is, we don't know whether we're looking at the tip of the iceberg or the iceberg itself.
There is a widespread fury and also shock. I don't think many people believed that MPs had their hands in the public purse to anything like this extent.
They've got to sort it out. It's got to be transparent and it's got to be something which you can justify on the front page of your local paper.
I think they need to act quickly to punish the people who've actually broken the law, and they need to reform the system now, not wait for an inquiry.
Specifically, give the MPs a flat allowance which covers all sorts of things. You'll pay their staff directly by the House of Commons, not through the MPs.
I think perhaps the most immediate step that can happen is some kind of cull of the worst offenders that will be implemented by not the MPs themselves, nor even their party leaders, but perhaps by party activists. Practically what this would mean is that local parties who have to re-nominate their candidates for the next general election, they have to make those decisions about who their prospective candidate is now, and sitting MPs can be deselected, no longer re-nominated for their own seats.
I think there is no remedy other than much too late, bringing in a very strict new system, raising their pay a bit, not allowing them to claim for absurdities, furniture, gardening, food, for heaven's sakes. The ultimate best answer would be a large block of flats where they could all have a free flat. They'd all be identical and they'd make no profit out of it. But I don't see that happening in a hurry.
It's systemic. It affects not just one government or one party, but it affects the whole system and all the parties.
I think there is no answer. I think the real deep damage will be long-lasting, permanent. This is the worst thing to have happened to Parliament since the war.
I want to know who's going to be the Pods and Widdicombe. She's been saying this week's been a competition for whose shirt is hairier than the others. Jackie, any defence?
I will give a mild defence. I do think some of them have been unfairly traduced. I mean, talking to a lot of them at Westminster, it's amazing how unrepentant a lot of them are. But some have been unfairly traduced. They have just made fairly ordinary claims. They've put in for being away from home allowances. Haven't we journalists done it when we go to the party conferences? We actually claim for lunches, dinners and what have you. That kind of thing. They put in a bill and, you know, then they're sort of harangued for claiming for a plastic bag or something. It just happened to be on the receipt.
Who's the most unfairly traduced one?
Well, I don't know. There's quite a lot of them. And I think what's interesting is what we haven't yet seen, what I would like to see, is a full list of the ones who have behaved very honourably, because I think there are quite a lot. The thing that worries me actually about that is there are some of them who do have private money. They go smugly, well, I haven't done anything, I haven't claimed anything, but you know perfectly well they're either married to somebody very rich or they've got family money, and I think that is a danger.
Nick, okay, well, defence over with.
Yeah, that was enough. That was a very mild defence.
Valiant, though, valiant. Nick, you know, we heard that clip there. Everyone, all our comment team, all thinking something needs to be done. But what do you think is realistic that we might hope could be done now?
Well, we are a democracy, and if I hate to say this in this company, if national newspaper columnists have a fault, is we underestimate the importance of local in Britain. And already there was Health Minister Phil Hope, I think it was paying back £40,000. That's because his local paper has gone absolutely wild. And he knows he'll be out of a job, and he'll probably be out of a job anyway. Constituency parties and constituency Labour parties and Conservative associations, the people who've been most betrayed in all of this are, if you like, local political activists of all stripes who, for nothing, tramp the streets and put out leaflets and organise, I don't know, jumble sales or coffee mornings that raise a couple of hundred pounds here, a couple of hundred pounds there, and they're looking at their MPs now, or the ones who have been, you know, I agree with Jackie that some have been unfairly treated and others have behaved totally honourably. There's far too many who have not, and how are they going to react? I think we're going to see a lot of deselections, and I think if there aren't deselections, the next election campaign is going to be very populist and very tough, because you know, if you're say a Lib Dem up against the Tory who's got the moat, you put it on every election leaflet, you go round every house, you turn it into a massive issue, and rightly so in my view, I think.
Madeleine, in the case of Phil Hope in Corby up against Louise Bagshaw, who's this target seat 28 for the Tories, would you feel the local party just get rid of him? And what Nick was talking about, this new era of clean politics, is this an ideal opportunity to get started?
Well, I think the idea of sort of local parties getting rid of their MPs is a good idea. The problem is the Labour Party at that level is so completely sort of exhausted, and you know, the membership has so kind of declined that does it really have the vitality yet to actually kick them out? I think that's definitely one aspect of what needs to happen, that kind of local engagement, you know, and they make some decisions. But I also think we need a much more kind of national reckoning, and that may be some sort of form of commission. I mean, what there is here is a political system which is completely morally bankrupt now. So the politicians themselves can't sort it out. And I think the interesting thing is you have to sort of thrash around to think, well, can we create some kind of commission which can command the sort of authority and kind of respect of a large number of
people
in this
country? Was
it made
morally bankrupt this week, or has it been going that way for a few years? I've lost track of the number of times people have said, you know, after this, we can no longer trust our political classes.
Well, you know, there is a kind of trend here. There was a really bad moment in the mid-90s under Major with sleaze and brown envelopes, and everybody said this is the worst moment since the war. Mm. And now we realise that actually, no, it can plumb even further.
You think this is worse than that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that the other thing which is really politically damaging is that in the last year, we've seen two forms of political failure. One was about the capacity to actually run the economy and run a very complex financial system. And the other is actually, you know, running their own financial system. So there's a kind of symmetry here. And I think the two things are unbelievably damaging.
I think the two are connected, Madeleine. Maybe this is being too speculative. But if you look at the way too few people in politics thought there was something going wrong with the city, had an instinctive, particularly from the left, an instinctive Labour reaction against the funny money, against excessive wealth. Or if you were a Conservative listening to this programme, you might think how few MPs have complained about the gross waste of public money in, say, the salaries for people in quangos who are earning more than the Prime Minister. Well, you see this and you look at the way, not just they're making a lot of money, but the furtive, almost semi-legal way they're doing it, and think, well, people who are doing that are not going to be on the lookout for people in the city or people in the public sector who are perhaps doing the same thing.
But isn't it all a part of the way people come into Parliament? Is they have to come in approved by the parties, with both big parties. They have to be sort of people that the leadership would like, and they then come in and they toe the line and they don't ask questions. And anyone who does start to ask questions, A, is jumped on by the media, and B, is given a roasting by Number 10 or by David Cameron's equivalent. So the whole ethos now at Westminster is to toe the line, to not make a fast, to be a good boy, and that's how you get on. And I think that's part of the problem. We don't allow mavericks in politics anymore.
Well, perhaps, Jackie, perhaps a good thing that could come of this, there will be more independents standing next election. Will be Martin Bells, the chap in Kidderminster who won.
The other side of that is possibly the BNP as well, who have got quite a clever slogan, haven't they? You know, punish the pigs. I mean, that's going to resonate, and maybe people won't actually realise the rest of the BNP agenda.
I was just going to ask, when you mentioned Martin Belnick, I mean, like, he rode to the rescue on his white horse in 1997. This is so much bigger, and we've got more notice before the election. Is there a chance you think that there'll be a whole army of them, maybe a new political party that's only about cleaning up politics?
Well, who can say? You've got levels on all of this. At the first level, you've got the party leadership. And I agree with Jackie. Although David Cameron looked more prime ministerial than the prime minister this week, there's something I didn't like about him being able to order senior members of his party to write checks. That reinforces the top-down authoritarianism of politics that Jackie was talking about. Then you've got constituency parties. Madeleine may well be right about the Secretary Labour Party shriveled to a couple of hundred members. Although we'll see, there may be more life in them than we think sitting here in London. But at the local level, anyone, this is a gift for political campaigners. You can download the PDFs, you can put it on leaflets, you can campaign. So anyone, either in an opposition party, and I suspect we mainly Liberal Democrats, simply because they're in second in lots of places and they're not overrepresented in all of this, or anyone locally who's got some local presence will be able to run a very, very tough campaign.
Madeleine, at PMQs, well, I sort of saw a shift in Cameron's positioning. I mean, Labour people said to me on the Tuesday, it was so depressing. You hear Cameron saying the words you wish Brown had it within him to say, and that they'd never found themselves saying that before. But then on Wednesday, PMQs for me felt quite party political. Him immediately going for the communications allowance is a very sensitive area. I mean, have you noticed the change, or did you think sort of across the board Cameron played it well this week?
Well, I think Cameron sort of did the best of a bad job, but the job was so bad that I don't think it really makes much difference. You know, this could not have been worse for the Tories. I think it unravelled, you know, much of what Cameron's been trying to do.
Do you think they have come out of it worse? Sort of, it's all relative, but do you think they have come out of it worse than the Labour Party?
Well, the funny thing is that how the whole thing exposes that wonderful English class system.
Yeah.
And this wonderful class system has always been defined by housing and the way you decorate your house. You know, people who buy their own furniture is the way we describe, you know, the lower middle classes. So there we get a bunch of Labour people in two up, two downs terraced houses in Southampton, you know, Margaret Moran, and then we get the Tories with their
the helicopters out.
The helipad.
It's like location.
And the wisteria. I mean, the wisteria is so Cotswold.
Nick and Jackie, do you agree that the Tories have done just as badly, or do you think it's
more
Labour?
Yeah, I do, actually. And I mean, I think at first Labour in despair, because there was day after day, wasn't there, of their stuff. And Cameron did do well with his sort of press conference saying, we're going to stop this. But I think now, as more and more is coming out, the Tories are doing badly. And I think it was a very cheap shot to try this stopping the communications allowance, because as everybody knows, the Conservatives have got Michael Ashcroft, lots of money, they don't need the communications allowance. So I think that is seen as really playing dirty party politics, trying to score electoral advantage out of a situation which actually he needs to be statesmanlike about, let's clean this up, rather than trying to sort of score extra hits for the forthcoming election.
And just in terms of this checks business, they're all writing checks like mad now, starting with David Cameron, but everyone else, Margaret Moran, whoever else. Is that going to work? We don't let burglars pay their way out of jail.
Well, you're also admitting guilt as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would help
That's
you come the next election.
Hope.
Far too late, I think, isn't it? And people aren't fooled by it.
Well, it is about this stage in any scandal that we ask where the head should roll and whose head. Well, one obvious candidate at the moment is the Speaker of the House of Commons, Michael Martin, who led a four-year battle to prevent MPs' expenses being made public. On Monday, he went on a little bit of a rant. He was angrily defending his decision to ask police to investigate where the expense leak came from. He gave this dressing down to Labour's Kate Hoey.
I listen to the Honourable Lady often when I turn on the television at midnight and I hear her public utterances and her pearls of wisdom on Sky News. And it's easy to talk then. Let me put this to the Honourable Lady and to every Honourable Member in this House. Is it the case that an employee of this House, should be able to hand over any private data to any organisation of his or her choosing?
A no-confidence motion has been tabled by a Tory backbencher. Possibly you have the prospect of a Speaker being unseated for the first time in 300 years. And that was extraordinary, Nick, wasn't it? Or did you think good on him?
No, certainly not think good on him.
Sounded like
Kate Hoey divides people.
Sorry?
Kate Hoey divides
yes,
people.
Yes, but he is meant to be the referee of Parliament, the umpire of Parliament. She is a member of Parliament. She is entitled to make a point without being shut up.
Madeleine, it was a bit of I know he wasn't drunk, but it was a bit of a barroom brawl.
It was absolutely astonishing. I mean, I think this guy's got to go. I find the kind of efforts to move him are still inadequate. He needs to go really
fast. Six people with a piece of paper. Jackie, there's a reason why it's difficult to attack, the earlier we were talking about heckling in church, the idea that you would ever attack a speaker, no matter how.
Oh, yes, he's always been sort of sacred, a bit like the Pope, you know, you mustn't say anything about him. People have always been very worried in Westminster about attacking him. But I think for too long now, he genuinely has been a roadblock to reform, actually, when it comes to all sorts of things at the House of Commons, from changing the hours to less secrecy, to less of this sort of flunkydom, better communications for the parliamentary system. And I've sat on various worthy commissions trying to sort of bring Parliament into the 20th century, let alone the 21st, and it's always blocked by the Speaker's office. And I think this is just sort of the culmination of endless sort of series by MPs to bring themselves forward, to get themselves more modern, to get the internet, to stop all the secrecy, and he always blocks it.
And is it just this thing that they're terrified that that he won't call their name in a debate?
Well, exactly that. And you know, many an MP will say to you, you know, I vaguely had a little tiny criticism of him 5 years ago, and I've not spoken in the Commons since. And that is a real disadvantage if you're an MP. Because of the local press, of course, they love it. You know, even if there's no one there in the chamber, if you're called and you protest about the local playing fields being closed or something, the local papers love it and the MPs get lots of good publicity. If you're not called in the Commons, it's a real disadvantage.
John Mann, Labour MP, has been doing a lot of the running on this, saying everyone should just pay back everything, no questions asked. He says the idea of getting rid of the Speaker is a sideshow.
Well, it is to an extent. There were people talking, certainly when this all began, as if the system made them fiddle it rather than they fiddled the system. And people say, well, you know, this is the way it works and the Speaker has always done this, and find it is a sideshow. And, you know, to go back to what we were talking about originally, we are a democracy. Mm. In the end, it's not up to the Speaker or to any commission or standards in public life. It is up to the voters of this country. However, you do feel it's a bit like with Labour Party and Gordon Brown. There are 1,001 reasons not to get rid of him. However, he is leading you over a cliff. You know, what's your problem? You know, if you just settle in the Startists and the Conservatism, it is only going to be worse. It's going to be worse for the Labour Party if they keep Brown, and be worse for MPs if they keep the Speaker. There are very good reasons for not getting rid of him, not least because he's meant to have a by-election. But better than that, you know, he is meant to protect the Commons. But the one thing Jackie didn't put on her list, the one thing where he ought to have been conservative, where he ought to have been reactionary, where he ought to have been stuck in the 17th century, let alone the 20th, was protecting MPs from the state. And he didn't do that. He allowed police into the Commons. So whichever way you look at him, he's just been a disaster, really.
But there is a commission behind Michael Martin, and it does include people like Harriet Harman. I mean, isn't there broader culpability?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what I was asking yesterday actually is, you know, what's the Hall of Shame? What I want to see is a newspaper which has a spread which identifies exactly who are the people that have been blocking the reform attempts. And you know, we were talking to one campaigner, Freedom of Information campaigner, yesterday, and she described one of the officials in the Fees office. You know. Which indicated a kind of civil service culture of yes, well, absolutely, everything's fine, and you know. So I think there's many different kind of figures that really need now to be identified. Who stopped reform, when, why, and where? Because we've had all the sort of salacious detail, but there's an institutional breakdown.
The process that went wrong.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yes.
Double page spread.
Oh yeah, we'll do it on Sunday if you want. It's a perfectly good idea. I was just interested in Madeline's point about people being interested. A woman stopped me in the street and she said, "For years, Nick, you've been going on at people like me saying we ought to take a greater interest in politics." She said, "Well, we're interested now. We're agog."
But pushing away the piles of receipts in Westminster, the think tank Demos have been trying some loftier thinking. In a new book, they make the case for liberal republicanism, whatever that is. The director is Richard Reeves.
The Liberal Republic, what it argues, is that people have the space and the resources to construct their own lives. It's about people having the power to determine what the good life is for themselves, that institutions like the family and the state and the church can play a huge part in people's lives, but they're only ever voluntarily so. And the kind of ultimate test of what a good life is determined by the individual. That means people need capabilities, so education and health and so on, as the Marchese Sen argues. But it also means they need power in the form of individual budgets for health and education. And they need the space, they need the opportunities to live out conflicting versions of the good life. So freedom of speech is a hugely important part of a liberal republic, but so is money and power for people to live out that life. So take three examples to illustrate the thesis. One would be a strong preference for individual budgets in health and education, that people should, in a sense, kind of control the money if they've got a long-term health problem or social care needs, or indeed in education, that actually they should be able to choose the service, a package that suits them. Secondly, would be a strong move towards a kind of civil libertarian position, if you like, and the repeal of legislation on attempts to criminalize incitements to religious hatred, for example. And thirdly, around tax policy, a significant rebalancing of the tax system so that unearned wealth, inheritance, and capital gains should be taxed very much more heavily than income, because the income that people are earning is through their own efforts as individuals, as independent individuals, whereas money that comes to you through capital gains or inheritance is not earned. And so a liberal Republican would be very much more quote-unquote left-wing on tax, inheritance tax if you like, even if arguably more quote-unquote right-wing on areas like school choice. And so I think that demonstrates that it's neither left nor right, but genuinely thoroughly liberal.
Jackie, you were wearing a sort of wry smile through much of that contribution from Mr. Reeves there. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, try putting that to someone on the doorstep and I think you'll get the door slammed in your face. I'm beginning to think we've had enough political philosophy over the last few years from the third
way
onwards.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Perhaps we could do with a little bit more practical common sense. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about individual budgets in the health service. Because of various relatives' problems, I've spent an inordinate amount of time in and out of hospitals over the last year, you know, and I can tell you that actually someone that starts to consider the patient's needs rather than any grand philosophy in the health service is the person that's going to unlock this problem of the health service not delivering. And I just think, you know...
You wouldn't have wanted to be able to control the budget yourself.
I don't think that's the beginning of the problem. Right. And I think we get all these lofty ideas from people in seminars who probably don't spend a lot of time trying to get an elderly relative, washed and fed and so on. They're all these bright young 30-somethings who actually probably don't have children or elderly people or anything else that aren't actually in the hospitals. And I think, no, individual budgets are not the answer at all.
Don't you want politicians to engage with big ideas? Don't you want...
Absolutely, yes. And I thought for Labour in particular, I mean, we have an exhausted government, a government that's dying in front of us. We have a probability of a Conservative Party coming into power, Labour, the centre-left rather, because I mean, I don't think Richard Reeves would like to be tied down to the Labour Party, desperately needs new ideas. And one thing, sort of contra Jackie, that has quite clearly happened is surely Fabianism is dead now. Surely we have tested to destruction the idea that the centralised state in London can set targets for the whole country, can distribute money over the whole country. I mean, people, including colleagues on this newspaper, often say that Labour's been a very right-wing government. Well, it has in some ways. In other ways, it's been, from traditional sense, quite a left-wing government. It has redistributed vast amounts of wealth. It has spent enormous sums of money on health and education and law and order. And, you know... You can't keep saying the same thing. It hasn't produced the results it has. And to Jackie's rather dismissal of individual budgets, there was a very good Labour minister called Ivan Lewis in the Department of Health, and women. It was nearly always women, single mothers who had severely disabled children. Said, well, look, we've got this awful form-filling, pernickety, overbearing system where we have to account for everything and give approval for what we have to do to, say, a severely autistic child. And I said, all right, then, we will just give you a lump sum that is yours to control. And the liberation that had for women was...
Well, yes, if you've got the information and you've got the education to cope with it. I'm not dismissing
they're arguing for what they call a broker. But Madeline, I mean, actually, the authors would say about 3 years, whenever, they got in deep trouble in the think tank world because they described the deep
Sounds
poison.
Sounds hairy.
Yeah,
I know,
the stocks were full. They called Fabianism the deep poisoned well or whatever. They would say, and Sunder, who's general secretary of the Fabian Society, would say, actually this is different because they don't like raising the threshold for inheritance tax. So they've drawn on some Fabian ideas. So they actually wouldn't say Fabianism is dead.
this long.
Just to come in, I think it's interesting because what we've had over the last 10 years or so is not actually Fabianism, it's new public management, which was an American idea that you could actually track money, you could impose targets, etc., etc. So this was tacked on to a belief, very Fabian belief, in the power of the state, and the state could deliver services and most efficiently and appropriately. So we've had a horrible mixture of two very controlling types of political philosophy. I don't think it's fair to really kind of, you know, label
jump on the grave.
And individual budgets, I mean, I find myself sort of agreeing with both Nick and Jackie, which is I really can't understand why they've become so fashionable, because they clearly work in some conditions, in some circumstances, in long-term chronic disability or special needs for children, etc., where you've got a very kind of committed and dedicated carer. Yeah, it's a great idea. But, you know, in many, many circumstances in the health service, it's kind of irrelevant. And the way it's been used as a sort of standard, a kind of rallying cry, you know, personalisation in education and individual budgets, as this somehow this is a rationale for the whole reform of the public services, I think it's just desperately overstretched.
What I found a bit odd about the pamphlet and the line of politicians they got to back it up, so Alan Milburn, George Osborne, Nick Clegg. But all these people, they've sort of, people with that sort of mindset have been running the country for quite a long time, and words like choice and empowerment have been buzzwords not just under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, but also John Major with his Citizens' Charter,
It's a very old-fashioned document. I mean, I find it kind of ironic that it comes out now when it's describing what we've basically kind of been living with for the last 20 years, which is this idea that consumer choice can be applied to the public services, that everyone can craft the good life for themselves. Hey, that's what these MPs have been doing. I mean, you know, the inadequacies and shortcomings of liberalism are precisely, you know, why Cameron is picking up bits of communitarianism, and indeed Demos is picking up bits of communitarianism.
But Demos would say actually the particular reason of why now, if you have a Conservative government in 2 years' time, how they sketch it is, look at the three parties, look at the battles they have within them. Within the Labour Party, you have the battle we just talked about. Within the Tory Party, you have Cameron actually being the Conservative side, where I don't think Osborne is an example, but Willetts or Michael Gove being a liberal conservative, Cameron being, with his marriage tax, an old-fashioned,
I think, what's interesting about this report is what it might do is actually flush out some of the real divisions that we do have within the Conservative Party. Because, as you say, even between Cameron and Osborne, the divisions, much bigger divisions between Cameron, Osborne and the Tory right wing, for example. And I think perhaps if we can get a bit of debate going, because, you know, what we all want to know really is what the Conservatives are about. Mm. We still don't really know very much.
I think the battle is almost within Cameron himself. That's the irony that, you know, there's two Camerons and they're not really resolved as to quite what his political makeup is.
Could I make a rather depressing point?
Let's end on a sour note.
Fabianism is dead.
What was the best way? What was the best way? Look, in some senses, there's an air of unreality about all of this, or individual budgets or centralised state. I mean, the truth is, you know, we are going to have the most grotesque public spending cuts for years and years to come. We're out of money. We're bust. And a more radical left-wing thinking will be looking at how can you provide good services to those who need it
on
shorter budget. Would be anti-managerial. Mm-hmm. Would be against the executives and the hierarchies, and would be trying to release the energies of people who worked in the public in the public sector, including you know, if you want to know where money is wasted in an organisation, people who work in it know it. People at the top rarely do, because hierarchies distance managers from what's going on the ground. And if anything, you know, the banks with most highly paid managers in the whole world proved that spectacularly. Didn't know what they were doing, didn't know what was going on.
Well, Politics Weekly can't afford to do anything more for you this week, I'm afraid.
Leave your thoughts on our politics blog. You can also leave your expenses there. It's at guardian.co.uk/politics.
Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. Till next week.
Goodbye.